there's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
There are a lot of things that matter to me. Family, community, culture, and peace of mind. Hi, it's Wilmer Valderrama, and when balancing life, I have to say nothing brings more comfort than having support. And when it comes to ensuring those things that matter to you the most, State Farm offers the support with an agent available in person or on the phone to discuss your coverage options. Support when you need it, however you choose. That's State Farm's way. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
I remember that first night Francis started cooking for everybody, all the actors and people that were there. Mario Puzo was there. I went into the kitchen and I said to Francis, can I help you, Francis, with anything? And he said, yeah. So I was just helping him, you know. I wanted to immerse myself in him, you know, in his world. And then at dinner, I sat next to Mario Puzo. And I said to him, Mario, is there anything you can say to me about Vincent, that you know, some insight in who you think he is? And he said, he has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael. I said, thanks very much. I'll work on that.
Welcome to More Than a Movie, a podcast that gives you a behind-the-scenes look at your favorite movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. Last season, we did a deep dive on American Me. This season, I'll focus on a different movie each episode, feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind them, and tap into the history of Latinos in film. In the life of a young Cuban-American kid growing up in Miami, there were basically two guys I could point to who were in movies or TV who felt like me. Desi Arnaz, who I named my daughter after, and Andy Garcia. I first saw The Godfather 3 when I was only 8 years old. Probably too young for a kid that age, but the star of that movie wasn't just anybody. It was this guy my parents were friends with. He'd gone to the same high school as my mom. He'd become friends with my stepdad in LA as two Miami Cubans trying to make it on the West Coast. And now he was starring in the sequel to what was explained to me, even then, as the two greatest movies of all time. And the older I got, the more important that moment has felt to me. Not just personally, but because it feels like a changing of the guard. After decades of watching Italians and others playing Latinos in movies like Scarface, here was a Latino guy taking on the mantle of the most famous Italian character of all time.
Nephew, from this moment on, call yourself Vincent Corleone.
It felt then, and it still does now, like we made it. So of course, when I knew we were doing a new season of the podcast, I knew I needed to call upon him to do a service for me. Andy, I'm so glad you could be here today to talk about...
I'm so happy I'm still around to talk to you.
Well, you're not only around, they're making a...
You grew up and so did I.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it. You have better hair than I do. we'll talk about hair.
I can't take credit for that.
This is a podcast about male hair care. So, Andy, I asked you here to talk about your career, but especially to talk about The Godfather and Godfather 3. A movie that for me, I don't know if I can overestimate the impact that the movie had. I mean, I remember being 8 years old. I believe the theater was on Miami Beach. I think it was the theater on Lincoln Road. And there was a screening, a special screening of the movie when it came out in 1990. Whether or not my parents should have been taking me to see The Godfather at the age of 8 is a different discussion.
Wow. Well, it worked out for you.
It worked out. And I remember seeing you on that screen and something changed for me. And I realized in that moment that I could maybe do that. It put the bug in me at
that age.
Of
course.
And part of that is because the representation matters, right? And you are a person whose story is very similar to my parents' story. You know, in fact, you grew up on Miami Beach. My mom grew up on Miami Beach, right? Both of you came as exiles from Cuba. So I wonder if we could just start maybe at the beginning.
I grew up in Miami Beach, and that's where I got exposed to films. You know, as a young boy, going to the cinemas from a very early age. There was one there around where we lived called the Surf Theater. In the summers, they had these programs in Miami Beach where you saw The Godfather at the Lincoln Theater. They had all these double features and during the summer, and I would leave the house and I would go see these double features. And usually they were adventure movies, but you saw movies like The Crimson Pirate and Captain Blood and The Great Escape and, of course, the Bond movies that began to come through. And I was very enamored with cinema. Obviously, it was a thing that I was very attracted to and I would get lost in.
Do you remember the first time you saw a Latino actor on screen? Do you have any notable memories of like, oh, there's a guy with a last name like mine or who maybe reminds
you know, some
me
of those old films, you know, those pirate movies and stuff had people like Gilbert Roland and those guys that were, they're Hispanic, but had changed their name. But I wasn't really saying that there was one particular then at the time. Actually, the one person that you really identified with was Desi Arnaz, who was on television in the Lucy Show. That was on all the time. So that was kind of like, he's of your culture, he's Cuban. And it was going, wow, you know, this is interesting. But I was not thinking consciously about that I wanted to be an actor. But subconsciously, I was being totally set up for it and influenced by it. To the degree that in my senior year in high school, at the beginning of the school year, at the beginning of the basketball season, I got a very bad case of mononucleosis. And my doctor, Dr. Pedro Greer, gave me the terrible news saying, you can't play basketball. You cannot exercise for 6 months or your spleen could burst. And so I was in this kind of emotional limbo. First of all, I was at home for like a month in bed, you know, trying to shake this thing. And I'd watch a lot of television, a lot of I Love Lucy, and you know. And then that year, I took an acting class at the high school, Miami Beach Senior High. And there's a teacher there named Jay Jensen, who was very well known, who taught Mickey Rourke, Ellen Barkin, a lot of folks. And I was very stimulated by the class, and he was very encouraging. And he kept encouraging me, you have something here, kind of, you should call, you know. And so that, I guess when I was in this sort of vulnerable state of not being able to have anything that was occupying my mind, which was sports, this other thing that I had inside of me, sort of like a virus, took over my body, my everything, my soul. And so it picked me kind of, you know, it was there all the time and it took over. And then I saw The Godfather. I was 72 when I was graduating. And like you said earlier, privately, I said to myself, that's what I want to do with my life. I want to aspire to do that. You couldn't tell anybody that because they think you were absolutely nuts, you know.
What's the reaction when you're like, mommy, papi, I want to be an actor?
Well, they have no relationship to it. You know, they have no conceit of how you even make a living as an actor. To them, an actor is Humphrey Bogart or Clark Gable, you know. And it's like, I can imagine is... I love my son, but he's not Humphrey Bogart.
Yes.
You know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was very difficult for them. They were very concerned.
What were the kind of things they would say to you?
Well, the thing was, it was an overnight thing. You know, I went from that moment in high school, I went to college at the local community college, and I took acting classes there. And then I went to FIU this last 2 years, because at the time, FIU was only a two-year school, and the last 2 years at that time. And then we went to school there, and I was in the theater department there doing plays. So they would come see me perform and all that, and they just felt it was like, he likes doing this. But when you're finished with college, you know, I was involved in the family business. I'd been trained there. It was flourishing. But then after college, it was time to, you know, sort of fish or cut bait. And I said, I'm going to LA to look for work in films, I guess.
When we come back, Andy Garcia plays tennis with the cast of Scarface. But before that, say hello to my little commercial.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
As an actor, a producer, and a proud Latino father, my days can get very busy, which is why I make sure to dedicate time to what's important, like supporting my community through my work, sharing my Colombian and Venezuelan culture, and being present for my family, which is everything to me. Hey everyone, it's Wilmer Valderrama, and we're reflecting on what matters most. I start by giving thanks for good support in my life whenever I need to make the big decisions. How about you? If it's insurance you need, State Farm is there to help you choose the right coverage for you. And State Farm offers great support 24/7. Just call an agent. State Farm is also a big supporter of my Cultura podcast network by helping to share our Latinx voices. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Listen to new episodes of your favorite My Cultura shows wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Welcome back to More Than a Movie. I'm your host, Tony Montana. Let's continue our conversation with Andy Garcia as he makes his way out of the vortex that is Miami and out to Tinseltown. So you moved to Los Angeles. You flew out here, and then was there anyone here that you knew?
Yes, actually, Stephen Bauer was here, who I had known from Miami.
Better known as Manolo from Scarface.
Yes, Stephen, and his original name was Stephen Echevarria, or Rocky.
Rocky Echevarria. Yeah.
So he had called me. We were friends from Miami. I had done an episode of that show that he was doing in Florida, and we rode together. We were friends, and he said he came out here. He had representation. He got a job. He got hired by Columbia Pictures Television as a contract player. And he said, hey, there's work out here. Come on out. So that encouraged my move. And when I came out here, there was nobody waiting for me here. You know, yeah, and I didn't have an agent. And so the process began, you know, of trying to find representation, trying to find work, pay the rent, you know, so.
And you'd done some TV and film projects, very small ones. ¿Qué pasa, USA?
And I did a movie in the Dominican called Wawasi, which was one scene in a movie. But no, I hadn't really been on you know, I'd done this theater. And when I came here in those days, I kept studying. And I went to take classes and eventually became a member of one of the house improvisational theater groups at the Comedy Store. And that's where I started to get some exposure to casting people and got a little work here and there because people would come to the show, you know, just trying to stay
active, honed.
Yeah, active. Yeah. While you try to find an agent, that was the most difficult thing, is to find someone that could get you out and audition, because if you don't audition, you can't get work.
And agents would say kind of out-of-pocket stuff to you back then, right? Like they would be like, you need to change your name.
Oh, completely.
You need to fix your teeth.
Fix your teeth, change your name, lose your accent, and come back to me.
Were you aware you had an accent when you got
yes.
out here?
Yes, were. Yes.
And how did you feel? Did you work on it?
I went immediately to a speech therapist and worked on it. And they dissect where your issues are, where you tend to lean on that side of it, and you become aware of it. And you do exercises to train your mouth and your tongue.
Yeah.
You know, without losing sort of your character, but just to neutralize it.
Yeah.
And as an actor, you want to be able to play other things, and you don't want the accent to get in the way. Of course, you can put on an accent. It's like you see all these great actors and actresses from Australia mm-hmm. or from England, and they're on a show or in a movie, and they have a completely neutral sort of American accent. And then when they're being interviewed, they go right back to their thing. So you
work on neutral, but you almost right away, it seems. How long did it take? I mean, you started on shows like Hill Street Blues. I know you did like an episode of Murder, She Wrote. You got these kind of like guest
parts.
Yeah,
these were bit parts.
Right?
Bit parts.
And, but I mean, that's, you know, at the time, did you feel like they were bit parts? I mean, I would have been excited, I think.
Sure. I mean, you know, but literally there were like bit parts, like one scene or a bit in a scene.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't like you were there for this whole story, you know. But yes, I was excited to work and to get my SAG card and to make some money and to validate that you can function. You're also learning actually being on set and being in an environment. And slowly those things would turn into something else. But at the time, I was working many other jobs. I was loading trucks at Roadway, you know, those trucks that say Roadway mm-hmm. in the city of Commerce. I would load and unload trucks in the night shift from 7 in the night to like 5 in the morning or something like that.
Wow.
All night long. In fact, I work with a lot of actors that were there. Bryan Cranston worked with me in the,
no.
there at Roadway. And so, you know, we all did all kinds of jobs. I worked as a waiter at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, banquet waiter. That was pretty steady because I can call in and work when I wanted to. At one time I went in there. Here's a curious thing. I went into this place I was working and I would just call in. I wouldn't say, well, what's the event? I'd just say, do you need an extra waiter? And say, yes, come in. And then I got there and it was the Golden Globes.
Huh.
And I was assigned to work on the Coming Home table, which was directed by Hal Ashby, John Voight, Jane Fonda, Bruce Stern, right? When the movie won, it was a very celebrated film. But Hal was one of my heroes as a director. And then later on, I actually got the opportunity to work with him.
8 Million Ways to Die.
8 Million Ways to Die, which was a movie that really changed my life, you know.
Let's talk about that. I mean, you're doing these kinds of parts. You're booking seemingly larger roles now in film, but not huge sort of plant your flag in the sand kind of roles. And then you book 8 Million Ways to Die.
Well, it's a process, you know.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. When I came here in those days, as you know, the parts that were written, that were character, that were Latin, predominantly they were nurses or maids or gang members.
Right.
Basically, that's what it was, the predominant. 90% of all the parts, and they were basically parts in a movie. They weren't a character necessarily that was part of the story. They weren't writing lawyers and, you know, like Hill Street Blues, although they had a lot of sort of delinquents and gang members, they also had Rene Enriquez played like the chief of police or one of those guys. You know, the thing is that those parts that were available for me, I could never, because my name was Garcia, people would see me just for those parts. I'd go in to play a gang member, specifically a Mexican American, you know, Chicano gang member. Physically, I didn't fit in that group, you know? So they would look at me and go, what are you doing here? I said, well, you called me in. He goes, I'm sorry. We saw the name Garcia and we called you in, but no, you know, you're like the diplomat's son. You can't play this part, you know? So, and I said, I'm an actor. You know, you argue and they go, no, I understand, but we'll call you in for something. Anyway, there was no something else. And I wasn't being considered like many actors with a Latin name for parts other than those Latin parts, right? So
yeah.
I was in a quandary of no opportunities until a movie came up that was shooting in Miami called The Mean Season with Kurt Russell. And it so happened because it was Miami, the young cop detective was Cuban.
Mm.
And so now I became one of the shortlists to potentially play that part. And I got that part very quickly. Jane Jenkins was the casting director, and she brought me in. Met her, met the director. He says, the part's yours. And then from that movie, I started to get interest. They asked me to come in. They wanted me to be a reoccurring character for the season on Cagney and Lacey as a kind of a love interest. And because in those days, television, there was this sort of thing about taboo that if you did TV, you couldn't
do film. Couldn't do both, right.
For some reason now. And so I rolled the dice and I turned down the part to stay in like in the game, sort of in the film game. And I was working, doing voiceovers in Walla and supporting my family that way. I had a little girl at the time.
Dominique,
yeah. She was very young. And that work was providing the rent and insurance. And then 8 Million Ways to Die came in. And my agent said, you know, there's this Hal Ashby movie. They're looking for this antagonist opposite Jeff Bridges. I read the script. The first script that they started the movie was with an Oliver Stone script. And later on, that was changed, and there was a rewrite and another rewrite, and we ended up basically, at the end, improvising all our scenes.
But wow.
Lynn Stallmaster was casting it, and I couldn't go in to see him. He wouldn't see me. He kept saying to the agent, I know Andy's a lovely actor, but we're looking for someone like a Hector Macho Camacho type. You remember the boxer?
Yeah.
And Andy's more like the diplomat's son, you know, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I kept pressing. I said, please, just ask him, just get me in. I know who this guy is.
It's already so hard because there's so few Latin roles. And then to be told, well, we need, you know, Latin 0.013, this very specific typecast.
Yeah, they were, you know, kind of this urban, tough, crazy guy.
Sure.
And I said, I know who this guy is. And eventually my agent was relentless and Lynn said, okay, I'll, you know, bring him in. And then I knew when I went in there that I had to go in the character. You know, I couldn't go in there casually and then just do the scene. So I just went in character and I read for Lynn. But basically, you know, you kind of roll the dice. You got to roll the dice and make an impression because you only got one shot. And I used to smoke in those days. So I started to smoke before, you know, as we were about to do the scene, I started to light a cigarette and Lynn said, I'm sorry, we can't. There's no smoking here. The character's name was Angel. And I said, Angel doesn't give a fuck what you think. And he kind of looked at me and he knew that it was an actor thing. You know, he kind of shook his head and go, oh, shit, here we go. You know, and then he said, can you mind if we go to another room? And I said to him, wherever we're going, I've already been. And wherever you've been, I don't need to go.
And he was like, that's it.
Yeah. And then he went, okay, just follow me. And then, you know, we went. Then I met, you know, the story goes on.
Right.
You know, he was a coked out, you know, no morality, no remorse kind of guy. And Hal just, after the reading, Hal said, okay. And I got the part. So that got me a lot of attention. And that's what opened up the door for The Untouchables.
So you do these movies with these incredible directors, Brian De Palma, Ridley Scott, Hal Ashby, and then...
Jerry Schatzberg early on too.
And then tell me about how does this Godfather 3 thing materialize? Because as you told us, you know, as we know, like The Godfather is this movie that you watched and said, I want to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like a thing that you manifest your own destiny, you know, in a way in life. In the early 80s, when I was loading trucks, there was a rumor, not a rumor, there was public, like in Variety, that they were going to do Godfather 3. And there was a new part, the son of Sonny. All that was kind of leaked.
Mm.
And that they were looking at actors like John Travolta or Sylvester Stallone, whatever. The people that were known and they were Italian, the usual suspects that were, you know, especially John was a big star. And I remember saying to myself, that's my part. That's my part. But, you know, I had nothing to show. But internally, I didn't tell anybody, you know, hey, that's my part. I just said to myself, that's my part. That's my part. So when it did happen in 1989, it gave me an opportunity to do some work where I had done a lot of work at Paramount. Like you mentioned, what was it? Untouchables, mm-hmm. Black Rain, you said. Dead Again, Internal Affairs, which they wrote for me.
Right.
And that was like 88 or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And we were doing the film and Frank Mancuso Jr., he said, hey, the chief wants to come have lunch with you. This is like May. So he comes to the set and we're having lunch and he says, the movie's going great. We've seen dailies, it's going great. He says, what are you doing in September? Remember, this is like May, June, because I'm going to talk to Francis. I want you to be Vincent in The New Godfather. And I said, I'll check my schedule. I'll get back to you.
Quick pause. For all the stronzos out there who don't know, the Francis he's talking about here is The Godfather director Francis Ford Coppola.
And I told him I'd be honored to do it. And so what happened was from like May or June, throughout the whole summer, there were other people that wanted that part, of course. It was a beautiful part. Every actor in town wanted that part. Who wouldn't want that part? And Francis started to screen test people. Now, if you know the history of The Godfather with Francis and the struggles he had with the studio when they would suggest people for the movie, it's become like film lore, right?
Yeah.
So I was the guy the studio wanted, and I wasn't Italian. But then again, neither was Brando and neither was
that's right.
James Caan.
No.
I wasn't Italian, right? So didn't bother Mr. Mancuso.
A lot of people don't realize Marlon Brando is not Italian.
Dad, right. But I had played Italian in, you know,
a couple times, right?
Yeah, in The Untouchables, in Black Rain. Yeah. And, you know, so I purposely was, you know, I had shots now to play things outside of my own culture. So,
yeah.
So anyway, he was screen testing people and I was always asking, why can't I just go and screen test? I'm going to lose the job. Because I'm not getting a shot to meet Francis. And then finally, like in August, they called me and I flew in and met him. It was a beautiful meeting and I left. There was no reading or anything. And then they kept screen testing and I kept saying, why can't I just screen test for him? And the agent says, don't worry. The studio wants you. I said, I understand, but people are going screen testing. Why? Let me just screen test. And finally, on a Friday before Labor Day weekend, a Thursday, I get a call, Francis wants to test you, and get on a plane. And I met Francis that afternoon on Thursday. They gave me the size. He talked about the character together and this and that. I went home, not home, to the motel there in Napa Valley, which is, if you've ever been to Napa Valley, at night it's pitch dark, you know.
Yeah.
And whatever little light there is, it's just like if you're in a motel or something. These are little bungalow motels. And there was a electrical shortage, you know, all the lights in the valley went out. So now I was sitting in my hotel room with one of those little, you know, candlelight things like Scrooge that they gave me at the office, trying to work on the material. And eventually that gets you very tired, goes your eyes. And I went to sleep. I woke up early, looked at the material again, went in and screen tested. And it went well. And as I was taking my wardrobe off and putting my clothes, Fred Roos, who was the casting director, one of the producers, said, well, I had met during the main season. So he was supportive. He was one of the guys who was saying to Francis also, this kid's
this is the guy. Yeah.
But I was the last guy in, you know, to test. He said, Francis would like you to stay for dinner. And then by the time I put my own clothes on, there was another knock on the door and he said, there's been a change of plans. You can go home, you know. So I said, okay, whatever. And I knew that, you know, that I felt good about what I did and that's all I could do. The next morning, I got a call on Saturday saying you got the part and go fly back up. On Monday, you start after that weekend, we started rehearsal in Napa Valley.
And I know, look, and I know for years in your mind, you're like, this is my part and you've been sort of preparing yourself for
yes.
it. But you don't know the details of the arc. You don't know exactly what's happening. And this is a movie.
No, I knew that this character was going to be handed the family.
Right, but you didn't know where all the road postings are, right?
No, I hadn't seen the script yet. I just seen sides.
So what I think is so beautiful about this performance is that it really does justice to the idea of someone who is Sonny's son, you know?
Right.
Who makes this transition to essentially being Michael's son, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
I wonder, like, did you talk to James Caan? Did you talk to Pacino? Like,
well, I worked with Pacino.
Of course. Yeah. But before starting, was there any kind of like...
I actually knew Al because we used to play paddle tennis together. I met him because when they were doing Scarface, Steven, you know, is a friend.
Right.
And Al loved to play paddle tennis. And Steven said, come play with us. And I met Al that way. And we would play paddle tennis in Studio City. There was a course there. And sometimes we go out to the beach in one of those beach clubs out there. And play. So Al is the warmest guy in the world. And I remember when Steven introduces and he said, Al, look, you see, I told you, you guys look alike, right? And Al said, yeah. And that was it. But he was very warm. We laughed a lot. So I knew Al just socially a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
So when I got to, you know, to Napa on that Monday, the first day, and, Al, you know, we kind of said hello and I gave him a hug. It was kind of like, Hal said, Of course, it's got to be you. You know, you have a resemblance, you know, for the family and all that stuff, you know. But no, I didn't talk to anybody. I had the material. I remember that first night Francis started cooking for everybody, all the actors and people that were there. Mario Puzo was there.
Wow.
I went into the kitchen and I said to Francis, as you know, because I like to cook, like your dad and our culture. And I said, can I help you, Francis, with anything? And he said, yeah. And he took a head of garlic. I never forget this. And he, with his hand, he's got very strong hands. He just pressed on it and the whole garlic just fell apart, like crushed it. And he said, peel those for me. And I said, sure. And then I started peeling the garlic. And he said, wait a second, hold on a second. And he grabbed them like that off, you know, scooped them off the table and put them away. And he said, no, I'm going to do a sauce that Mario likes instead, which is just with onions. So he said, cut these onions. I guess I cut the onions. And then he said, go out to the garden and bring me a big bushel of basil. He had it in the garden outside his house in Napa. So I was just helping him, you know.
Yeah.
I wanted to immerse myself in him, you know, in his world. And then at dinner, I sat next to Mario Puzo. And I said to him, Mario, is there anything you can say to me about Vincent? That, you know, some insight in who you think he is. And he said, he has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
Oh.
I said, thanks very much. I'll work on that.
Also, no pressure, right?
Yeah, I'll work on that. Please don't tell me anything else.
Yeah.
Sorry I asked.
We're good.
If this podcast was The Godfather, my producer Chloe would be Michael, I would be Sonny, and this commercial break would definitely be Fredo. Stick around. We're about to bite off Joey Zaza's ear.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
I often get asked why I'm such a big fan of wrestling. And it's all thanks to my grandma. Growing up, we would watch matches together, and that bond turned me into a lifelong fan. Hi, I'm Freddie Prinze Jr., and on my podcast, Wrestling with Freddie, we know how important it is to have the right teammate, because things can get pretty tricky quick. So, when things get complicated and you need help, State Farm gives you options. They show you what's possible for ensuring what matters to you. One of the things that matters to me? Sharing memories and revisiting wrestling's greatest moments. And with State Farm's support of the My Cultura Podcast Network, I get to do just that. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Listen to new episodes of your favorite My Cultura shows, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Welcome back to More Than a Movie. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. I'm talking to Academy Award nominee Andy Garcia about being cast as Vincent Mancini, aka Vincent Corleone, in the 1990 sequel to arguably the greatest films of all time, The Godfather Part III. So I'm wondering, you know, talking about that performance, movies are not typically shot in sequence. You know, you don't shoot it in the order that you see it in the film.
No.
You see this very, I mean, look, the reviews say what they say, right? I mean, like New York Times, everybody talks about how great your performance was in the movie, you're nominated, you know. So it's a great performance, but I want to sort of talk a little bit about the work that goes into that performance and how did you map starting in this place where you're like literally biting Joey Zaza's ear, mm-hmm. you know, to you know, these final scenes sitting in the chair, very reminiscent of that Godfather one shot with, you know, Diane Keaton sort of watching in the distance as the door closed. So how do you do that as an actor? What's the process?
Well, you talk with Francis a lot because, like you said, it wasn't shot in sequence. The script was changing a lot from the first script I had. Dean Tavolaris, a great production designer who worked on all those films with Francis and our film, he said something. It's like the screenplay is with Francis like a newspaper. It comes out every day. So you would get sometimes new pages every day, and I would ask him, where am I at, Francis, in the situation? You know, some of it was obvious that it was in the first act. Some of it was like, I had done this preparation with Milena Canonero just with hair, where my hair started. I kept all those shots. It's about 15 images that start with very curly hair.
Uh-huh.
And then it slowly gets more and more slick like Michael. He gets refined where he's not as hot-tempered and he's colder. He's prepared to kill anybody, but he's more, Al is, you know, Michael has mentored him. And all that stuff.
Don't ever tell anybody what you're thinking.
But, yeah. And all that stuff was talked about and evident in the material. But there was this one thing where there was a scene in the script that we all read where he gives me the family. And that scene, as we got into scenes towards the end of the film, we hadn't shot that scene at all. And I'd asked Francis, I said, Francis, in this scene, because it was kind of like borderline, I said, where am I at with, have I gotten the family yet? And he says, we haven't shot that scene yet.
I would
go like, okay, I got you. And then we just work and work and work. And actually, we finished shooting the film and we never shot that scene. The studio wanted it to happen, but Francis never shot the scene in the original production time. And he went and cut the film together. And then he came back to the studio and said, okay, now I have what I want to do. I need to this. And we shot like another 30 days.
Oh, wow.
And he says, and now I have the scene where Vincent gets the family.
One of the most notable elements of Andy Garcia's performance in this movie is how he's able to capture the spirit of both his father, Sonny, and his uncles, Michael and Fredo, at different times in the film. His arc from Sonny to Michael is what gives credibility to Vincent's ascension to the Godfather throne. Listen to this clip from the beginning of the film, where the character is still struggling, like his father, to control his temper, especially where his family is concerned. It's a quality that ultimately got Sonny killed.
I'm not here to ask you for any kind of help. I could just kill this bastard. He's the one who needs the help.
So kill him. What does all this have to do with me?
Well, he's going on behind your back saying fuck Michael Corleone all the time. That's it. That's one thing it has to do with you, right? Say it to his face one time. Say it to his face one time.
Mr. Corleone, all bastards are liars. Shakespeare wrote poems.
What am I going to do with this guy? What am I going to do with this guy?
That was Andy Garcia trying not to kill Joey Zaza, as played by Joe Mantegna, after he's allegedly caught Zaza speaking ill of his uncle Mike, a.k.a. Michael Corleone.
So there's a few moments in this movie that I adore. A couple of them revolve around Joey Zaza.
Mm-hmm.
So
Joe Mantegna, yeah.
Joe Mantegna's character, exactly. So you bite Joey Zaza's ear off in an early scene. Right? Basically the beginning of the movie, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And then Joey Zaza puts a hit on you, famously. I think it's Bridget Fonda, right? Is the...
Well, she...
She's the journalist
who's
with
you? Journalist that I take home from the party. And the guys come to try to take me out. She happens to be there.
Which is a great scene where you're like, I want you to watch me very carefully and then shoot the guy in his mouth. But then you go to see Michael sort of as like a, you know, hey, this happened kind of thing. And Michael says something to the effect of, you know, now Joey Zaza is going to come back on you.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, Joey Zaza is going to come back on me. And you flick your ear a couple times.
Yeah.
Was that in the script?
Or no.
You just decided to flick your ear?
Yeah, but that's a gesture that Joey, that gesture is sort of like that he doesn't really have the wherewithal, the toughness or, you know, the, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're definitely like emasculating the guy. Yeah. You're dressing him down there.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's just like you just bit his ear and then we see you do this. Yeah. It's so like delightful. But that was just like a
improv moment.
And
then later
on,
you know, in the Cavalleria Rusticana, where he bites, that's from the opera.
Oh, right.
My stepbrother, you know, Michael.
Yeah. The opera singer.
Yeah, he bites the guy's ear. And so Francis had that set up, you know, that was part of his, like, from a script idea, a story idea. And there's a very nice moment when he does that in the opera. They cut to Vincent. Vincent has like a smile, you know. Yeah. Like if it was an homage to him. Yeah, instead of
yeah,
him.
Yeah, yeah. He pulls on his
but
ear.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting that the first take we did, Joe had a prosthetic ear, you know. And I went in and, you know, they had a shot there, very fairly close shot. And after I bit it, I came away and I had the ear in my mouth.
Oh.
You know, the prosthetic ear in my mouth. And it was on camera, like you could see it. And I think Francis said, oh, that's a bit too much, yeah. Whatever. And then we did another take, which is what's in the movie, you know.
Where you don't like bite it off. You just.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. Supposedly, Francis said to me, after, you know, when I step away, he said, why don't you get yourself like a, do we have like a piece of a hot dog or something so you can have it in your mouth? Because you took a piece of it. And there was no, and I said, don't worry, Francis, I'll play it. And you see me kind of taking something out of my tongue. Like if I have something. You know, a piece of his ear in my mouth. You know?
Yeah, it's visceral. Yeah.
So that actual scene was the one I auditioned. The screen test was the scene where I come into the office for the first time. That's one of the scenes.
Just to clarify, so do you think that the wicking of the ear thing, do you think that's because of your like improv comedy training? Like where does that kind of come from?
It's just from my own imagination, you know. It's things that you bring to a part.
Does it happen in the moment or do you plan it?
No, I had the thought of how do you degrade Joe Zaza's ability to retaliate? Or Joey Zaza is a putz kind of thing, you know.
And how do you cut him down sort of each scene?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And then the other great moment, which I'm very curious about the timing of, is when you finally put the hit on Zaza.
Mm-hmm.
And you ride up in the horse. This is like, I've memorized this in my head. And you say, hey, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
And he turns around. And you shoot twice. And then the horse turns. You shoot a third time. And then you go, Zaza. And you ride away.
Zaza.
And I've always wanted to know, is that sequence something that you planned? Or was that
No, that's
like-
all Francis. There was actually a scene that doesn't exist in the movie where you saw me getting dressed at the stable in a police uniform. Like a matador getting ready for a bullfight. It was a beautifully shot scene because you had like the horse was there and it was dimly lit, like light was coming through like a skylight. And you imagine Gordon Willis. But the reality is that spoiled the surprise. Once you knew I was in the police, you didn't
know. So I only have one last question. It's a true or false question. You were inspired to start acting because of The Godfather. I was inspired to start acting and then, you know, by extension, producing. Watching Godfather 3. You're now here doing my podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Am I now the Godfather?
I haven't retired yet.
Damn it. One day.
One day, and that day may never come.
Oh.
I might come to you for a favor.
Oh, there's hope. All right, man.
Thank you so much, brother.
I really appreciate it. Just when you thought you were out, we pulled you back in with next week's episode of More Than a Movie featuring actor and honorary Latino Lou Diamond Phillips, who we'll be talking to about his role as Richie Valens in La Bamba. More Than a Movie Season 2 was produced by Chloe Tagliagambe with the help of Reynolds Gutierrez and Veronica Hernandez in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura Podcast Network. Hosted by me, Alex Fumero. Edited by Rose Reed and Chloe Tagliagambe with the help of Saida Quevedo. Executive producers are Carmen Graterol, Rose Reed, Isaac Lee, and me, Alex Fumero. Sound design by Gonzalo Messi. Original music by Golden Minds, Darko, and Ayeme. Recorded at JTB Studios and Vaudeville Sound. Our executive producers at iHeart are Giselle Bansis and Arlene Santana. For more My Cultura podcasts, listen to the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events,
You'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Tengo diabetes.
Yo, asma.
Estamos en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica.
19 años o más con afecciones crónicas como asma, diabetes, EPOC o enfermedad cardíaca, o tienes 65 años o más, estás en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20, una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Aunque te hayas vacunado previamente con otras vacunas contra la neumonía, Prevnar 20 puede ayudar a proveer protección adicional. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones de 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Los adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. Los efectos secundarios incluyen dolor e hinchazón en el área de la inyección, fatiga, dolor de cabeza, dolor muscular y en las coyunturas. Para obtener la información para la prescripción completa, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com.
What the world needs now is positivity. Connecting, relating, and being human together is where it's at. Hi there, Honey German, and I know life happens, but trust, you got this. And State Farm got us. It feels good knowing that State Farm agents are there to help you choose the right coverage with great support 24/7. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.